I was just going to agree with you. That's super cute. Like, their kids have Jesus, then they can be dumped by Chad. It's okay.
That's our closing statement. If your kids have Jesus, they can be dumped by Chad, and it'll be okay. Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you gentlemen today?
Great. Good. Thank you.
Good.
It's election day, and if we publish this at our normal time on Friday, all anyone will want to talk or think about will be election results. And since it's only Tuesday afternoon and we know nothing about election results, I think what we'll do is post this pretty much as soon as we can this afternoon. So I'm asking our listener to be forgiving about the relative lack of editing that will go into this show. Won't be up to our usual, you know, pristine Class A standards. So you guys, have you voted yet? Did you see a lot of fathers like the guy going viral proudly voting so that their daughters would have the right to kill their grandchildren?
Yeah, I saw that meme. That
it's not a meme, it's a guy.
Oh no, I saw a cartoon.
Did you see the one with the guy?
Cartoon. No, there's an interview of a guy outside a polling place tearing up about his vote for Harris that would quote unquote protect his daughters.
Now I get my daughters to murder my grandchildren.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I said in the rector's forum a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, if I was at a dinner party and it sort of dawned on me that all of a sudden the people that I was with were for abortion, pro porn, pro weed, you know, pro euthanasia, I would be like, I'm sorry, there's been a terrible mistake here. I'm going to have to excuse myself and may look God have mercy on your souls. Cause the cynical argumentation is so gross. I mean, did we talk about it on this podcast, or talk about it when, you know, one of the appeals to young men is that the Republicans are going to take away your porn,
yeah.
You know, I mean, they're going to take away your weed, take away your porn, take away your abortions. I mean, goodness, what a travesty that would be if any of that took place.
Yeah, it's like one of those, your terms are acceptable.
That's right. Giga Chad meme. That's right. Yeah. That's it really was, I mean, it's unbelievable, really. The idea that would be something that would motivate a father of a daughter, that somehow he would feel so impassioned to be weeping about the prospect of his daughter losing the ability to kill his grandchild. I mean, it's unbelievable, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's where we are as a culture, right? Because the fulfillment of the self is our highest value. I mean, who cares about the future generations? Who cares about a baby we can't even see? It's your pleasure, maximizing your pleasure and your satisfaction, your fulfillment right now is the most important thing. So my daughter, who I can see, I mean, I want her to maximize her fulfillment and pleasure. I don't
care. That's right.
About,
God forbid she become a mother. Like, we really want to be a CEO. Get in that cubicle as quickly as possible.
As many have pointed out, the shadow side of even this father's emotional statements are that he is wanting his daughter to be able to be sexually involved with men who have no intention of being a husband or father in her life. And that's a tragedy, a real tragedy.
Well, and it's an unbelievable change in such an incredibly short amount of time for what, you know, any civilization would have understood for millennia. You know, I mean, like
you have to get past Christian the girl's father to even
that's
meet
right
her.
And brothers. That's yeah. Right. And it would be and that there would be something sort of sacred or reverent about that, you know, the sort of, you know, relationship would be that the father would want to protect and to nurture and guide, is just been totally reversed. I mean, it's been, you know, it's really a wholesale abdication of masculine virtue, right there, you know, and it's sort of the triumph of the reversal of gender, you know, expectations and things. I mean, all the things. I mean, it's a civilizational moment, as Oz Guinness was saying in a podcast I was listening to him recently, where we, if we have this understanding of future generations being simply not to be protected or to be desired, but to be well, to be eliminated as part of our freedom. I mean, that's the two competing ideas of how the world works.
Well, to stay on the fathers and their daughters theme, but hopefully on a more pleasant aspect of it, as we wait along with our listener for election returns, we thought we'd spend today's episode talking about dating. That's right, a stand firm guide to dating. I got to thinking about this as a topic because Al Mohler took a question about how old a girl should be before she dates last week on the briefing, and because I myself now have a 16-year-old daughter who just asked me if she's allowed to date, catching me completely and utterly off guard. So I turn here to my friends in the faith, JD and Matt. I have a list of sort of dating-related questions here, but why don't we start with the big picture? Does the Bible have anything to say about dating and courtship and the seeking of a mate?
I mean, I think the model from the cultural model we get from the scriptures is that the father is the one who, guides a process like that, and helps the process go along. The reason women married so early in, say, first century and earlier ages is because you wanted to marry your daughter off as soon as she's able to have babies. So you guard over her so that she's not she doesn't have babies before she's married, but the period of time that there was between being able to have babies and being married is much shorter than it is now. So now we have this a huge gap between the time a woman and a man becomes sexually mature to a time that they're married, and that's I think that's historically unprecedented. I mean,
Really new, really new.
we're dealing with the things that the Bible didn't actually have. I mean, God, of course, knew that it was going to happen, but the Bible didn't really give us doesn't really give us a model for this. It gives us principles, which I think are in play here. And then the principles, of course, are that sexual purity and virtue are to be upheld until marriage. It's just harder now with the age range that we have to deal with. I mean, I remember reading, I forgot who wrote it, but he's a famous evangelical now who wrote
Joshua Harris, I'm sure, is who you mean.
Kissing Dating Goodbye.
I Kissed Dating Goodbye.
Yeah, I could say, yeah, that's what it was. And I remember really thinking, man, this is kind of unrealistic too. The book was somewhat like for the 10 years or however long it is between the time you reach sexual maturity and the time that you're married, just you treat every woman exactly like your sister. So you don't date, you have maybe courtship relationships, but you don't actually have any dates. And I just thought it was somewhat unrealistic. That was, of course, at the height of the purity culture era. I have a 22-year-old daughter, who's had three men pursuing her so far. So
Sequentially,
sequentially, right.
They have
And
all been bested in unarmed combat by
I've
Matt.
glowered at them and answered the door with my shotgun and done all
One has made it to the
that
fifth challenge.
I can do. So my other boys, my two oldest boys are now at dating age, or yeah, they're my youngest boy is 18, my oldest 20, and he may be getting married soon. So there's so I have some personal experience with this, and my goal, and I think it's held out pretty well. I mean, has been to tell all my children, look, your mother and I have what we have, with this beautiful family, this wonderful life, all that because we're your mother, not me. Your mother was she was bent on this being the goal. She wanted a family like this, and she knew that from the time she was a young teenager, and she made decisions based on that knowledge. And of course, based on what she knew of the faith. I wasn't a Christian until later in life. So of course, my example is null and void, but hers is a great one for Christian children. I mean, and that she had a goal, and that is to have a beautiful family life that reflects heaven. And she's brought that about. And she's brought that about by not sleeping around. We did date. She and I dated when we were younger, but boy, were the lines clear. There were very clear lines for me. And our children are experiencing the results of that. And so far, they are all, even the boys, very intent on mirroring their mother's behavior in the dating relationships. We do let them date, but we can talk about more about this caveat. We have some caveats with that. We can talk more about that later if we want to, but we do let them date, but we have some boundaries around that.
Well, I'm basically just listening to this conversation to a certain degree, because I have six children, one on the way, but they're nine and under. So, although to be fair, like they read a lot of classic literature, and there's a lot of discussion of romance and kissing and knights and princesses and things. And so we're starting this conversation. But I'm certainly looking forward to learning from it. I mean, I think the one thing you can say from the Bible is that it's not good for man to be alone. I mean, there's something good and beautiful about the desire for companionship, and certainly male female relationship takes on, in the normative pattern, in God's good pattern, some physical, at least desirous overtones, which is normal, particularly after you go through puberty. So I don't think there's any way to avoid it. But I do think, I was reflecting on this when Nick talked about the topic, because I said the main thing I could offer is just cautionary tales about what not to do, or at least kind of naivete about the power of these desires to sort of overwhelm or to corrupt even the most well-intended Christian person. And I think as I was thinking, I said this in a number of different contexts, but I don't think we can appreciate how radical the 70s and 80s were with respect to the sexual mores changing and the sort of free, final, sort of stable ability of birth control to just upend, millennia of understanding of male-female relations. And I think that, we all were born in the 70s. Or Matt, you remember, you were probably born in the late 50s, right? But the
71. I'm an Xer, we all were born, not a boomer.
You know, as children coming of age in the 80s, I have a lot of sympathy for, as I've said before, youth ministers and parents even who were came of age in the early 60s and perhaps weren't radical, ideologues, sexual ideologues. And, the culture changed so rapidly between sort of mainstream pornography, but also cable television and all the other things that came in. I think that the whole conversation surrounding men and women was overtly sexualized in a way that I think people just weren't aware of, and I think we were children in the midst of this. Ads changed, movies were begin changing, the whole conversation began changing around us. And I think that had a lot to do with the way that sort of, well, I can just say myself, well-intended young Christian kids get overwhelmed by the sexualization of the culture. And I mean, thank goodness, there was some protective guardrails, at least, growing up in Baton Rouge and sort of Baptistic kind of pre-church culture. But I have a lot of sympathy for people who just got mowed over or, got thrown into college in the, early 90s and were just, all of a sudden went from never having any of these temptations even be remotely accessible, if not legitimized, to just, free for all. And so I think that had an effect on the dating culture, because I think that people for sort sure. of naively said, well, what's wrong with someone going steady and spending, 6 hours alone, watching a movie upstairs? What's wrong with these things? Because what could possibly be happening to the to the people who'd grown up in the, late 50s, early 60s, was now, even if it had been imaginable, it wasn't, or if thinkable, it wasn't really plausible in the way that it became. And then on top of that, you see the normalization of it. I mean, I remember when Beverly Hills 90210, the big discussion about it was, who was it? Dylan was going to go to prom and sleep with, whatever her name was. What's her name? Doherty. And
Shannon
it was like
Doherty.
this, Anna Doherty. And it was this huge discussion that was, that wasn't fraught with any sort of morality or any sort of sense of, well, of course you shouldn't do this. It was just a question of whether or not, it was true love or something like that. And
Or
I
you could
think
show it
all
on
of that,
TV. Yeah.
yeah, I think all of that combines to make us really question, a lot of the sort of given assumptions or sort of normative patterns of quote unquote dating. That were at least normative in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, because we see now what is being, what we see the results of that. And so, again, that's what I've been thinking about, because I look at my own children and I say, some of the freedoms that or some of the liberty that I was given, I'm not giving to them in the same way. And it's not that I blame my parents or the youth ministers. They just didn't know any, and in a certain sense it was a caught everyone off guard, but we have been warned, and I think it's now our responsibility to protect them in a world that is much more hostile in this respect than it was before.
Yeah. What do you guys think of the? I'm sort of envisioning dating on a spectrum with one end being sort of like the libertine dating culture that I think we can see most readily in the West today, where boys and girls are sort of, in a sense, taking test drives with all the cars on the lot and seeing which one they like the best and which one fits with them the best. And it's sort of like, but maybe there's some theoretical perfect match out there for me. And this gets Christianized with there's, one boy or one girl who the Lord has picked for you. And like your job is to go out and find them. And if you start to feel something about somebody else, maybe that's the one, it's sort of like looking for Excalibur, if you might say it that way. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, you sort of have, Matt, what you alluded to as what has been true of basically the world over for all time, which is that your family was very involved in this process. And of course, in some cultures, you're not, in fact, involved at all. It's all your family. And they find another family that is connected in some way and they arrange a marriage. It seems like that's not even any more crazy, even though it sounds so foreign to us. It's no more crazy than seeking the one perfect match. So where are we? How do we navigate some kind of middle ground where we're not just trying all the cars on the lot in rebellion to our parents, but at the same time, we're maybe allowing our kids not to just have me pick some guy from the neighborhood and match you
Yeah.
up?
I mean, I keep, I'm going to go back to this principle over and over again, I think probably in this whole podcast. But if your own family life, like if your daughters are raised, your sons are raised in a home they love, and in a church they love, if they love church, they love Jesus, they love their family, they're just, if there's a good culture in your family, a good Christian culture in your family, they're going to want to look for people who have that, right? That automatically like sets them outside of the I'm just looking for somebody who is hot and I have the hots for, right? That already changes the dynamic. I'm looking for somebody who I can recreate this with. I'm looking for somebody who I can make this a new this the same culture I can replicate this culture with. And so you're not going to date a non-Christian. If your home life is that, and your church life is that, then you can't get that with someone who's not a believer, and you can't get that with someone who's not a believer or who is a believer but who doesn't share that same goal, right? Who doesn't want that out of their family. So, like, I'll speak with my daughter. I mean, she's the three men who have gone after her have been great men, no, good men. Nothing wrong with them, but she is looking for that. She's looking for someone who will help recreate this kind of culture that she's grown up with. And so, even if she might be attracted to other men who are not Christian. I don't know. I haven't asked her, but, and she might be embarrassed that I even said that, but even whoever she's attracted to or fuels her heart, you know, go pitter patter for, if they're not going to give her that, she doesn't want him. Right. And the same thing with my boys, if they might find a woman who's really beautiful, and, you know, objectifiable, but they both are very clear. I don't want a woman who is not going to be a good mother for my children, who's not going to give a warm home for me and my and everybody who we're related to in the church. So I think it goes back to like what you, creating an environment your kids want to replicate. A Christian environment your kids want to replicate when they get to that age. And that immediately, yeah, you don't want them to marry. You really don't want them to marry someone they're not attracted to. Right. If we lived 200, 300 years ago and I was arranging marriages for my daughters, I'd be totally happy. I'd be super happy. This would be my best life then. My best life now, but I can't do that. Right. We're living in the present day. So the best we can do is give them such a attractive, and not a false attraction, but a truly beautiful vision, to that it's more compelling than their physical urges, so that they'll look for a person who will help them build that.
Well, I have a couple more questions.
Did I kill it?
You alluded earlier to your rules for what to do on dates. Why don't you share some of those with us and see if they prompt some discussion?
Yeah, what are your thoughts about like chaperones, for instance? I mean, I can't see any positive to letting, 16, 17-year-olds, do a lot of one-on-one, deep discussions.
Yeah, most like at that age, like so my son, my first son, he met the girl that he's, well, we don't know what's going to happen, but they've been together for 4 years now, but they're in the same church and we know their parents, and they live an hour away from the church, but they're very involved. So what that has done, thankfully, is limited the amount of together time that they had when they were younger, right? So now that he's 20 and she's older too, there's a little more freedom, but there's still the distance issue. So I think those pragmatic and practical limitations.
Yeah, he has 3 more years to work for her father, right?
And like he has to go.
There's like something about cows. The cows. What are you going to do with all the cows?
Well, in the Philistine foreskins, he's got to go find those.
Right. And that's only the first three challenges.
That limitation they had, I think helped me think through what I want to do for the remaining children. You're right, Judy. I don't think there's a 16-year-old has any business being out with another 16-year-old in alone somewhere.
I think that chaperoning, sure. Obviously learning social skills from boys and girls, young men and young women. I mean, that's, we've been doing this for centuries,
right.
I mean, like sitting on the front porch with or going to sock hops or whatever it is, there's nothing wrong with these things.
Yeah, and that's how dating was done. I mean, even in the 50s, like that you just go with groups of people, right? You're not off by yourself in some weird.
I think the actual problem is just that it's the hypersexualization of things. I mean, right. I think if there was a world where the possibility of fornication was I mean, obviously it's always a possibility, but it was the exception, not the rule. I think that there would be a lot more, a lot less, it would be a lot less fraud, but the reality of it is, I mean, look at what we talked about in the beginning. The reality of it is there's not only a sense of a resignation to it. There's almost an expectation of it. I mean, there were magazines, I never saw one, thankfully, but we were discussing them in Germany while we were there, that was for, prepubescents, that were explicit to begin teaching them about the good of sex, so that, they could exercise this this bodily desire in a healthy way, the way that you learn how the, you know, the food pyramid or whatever, you know, I mean, that is just such a dehumanizing aspect of reality of, you know, it's literally animalistic what they're trying to teach to our children. And you see it with the sexualization down to the board books, you know, or for these things. And it really is like the triumph of Aldous Huxley's vision of breaking down the sense of self-control and sort of sacredness of sex. And I think that's where these kids are getting chewed up, just mowed down over it, because, you know, unless you have an explicit household and community that, you know, you're like you said, Matt, the other parents that you know with their kids, you don't know what's going on. If they're going over to, you know, their friend's house, you know, you have to be much more careful about all these things than you ever had to be. And it's not because we're sitting here, you know, holier than thou, you know, a bunch of prudes or whatever. It's just that there is a warning attached to fornication, in the Bible, and there's a real cost to it. You know, of course you can be forgiven and you can be redeemed and all these things, but as fathers, boys and girls, you know, it's our duty to hope, you know, strengthen them and to protect them as best we can, age appropriate. And I think that these, you know, you see these like, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls and boys talking about their boyfriends and girlfriends, and, you know, their parents think it's so cute, and they're talking about, you know, pairing off and going to the movies together and stuff. And you're like, this, you know, seems like we would have learned something by now. But instead, it looks like the culture is even ramping up and the ages are getting younger and younger, for when people are beginning to play with adult things as children, and they're suffering the harm that comes from that, and it's heartbreaking.
With your vision of the more beautiful family culture that your child will hopefully want to recreate for themselves, obviously, you're at least in theory dealing with another family with a potentially different culture. At what point do you feel like it's important to become involved family to family? Do you want to meet parents of prospective suitors right away? Is that like, let's see how serious this gets? How does that work?
Again, this does depend on the age, right? So like for the younger
If
ages,
your
like
son is 35, they're sort of on their own,
right. So like we're talking like from, you know,
Generally could
16
get.
I mean 16 or 17 year old, you definitely want to know what their family, what the other family is like. And it's not a deal killer if the family is a little bit is broken. But what might be a deal killer is the parents having not the same desire for the future of their child that you have, right? So like for example, you might have your daughter dating a boy whose parents are divorced, have been divorced, and they're trying to kind of push things back together, but they definitely want the same thing for their son that you want for your daughter. That's a great, that's not a, I wouldn't necessarily eliminate that. But if you have like a broken situation, like a Christian family, believers, you know, Christians, but no real, but really kind of more secular in their outlook on the family and on sexuality and all of that. I would be really cautious about allowing my child to date someone in that context. The one caveat to that would be if the son, I'm thinking here, my daughters. If a son came to our house and like loved our family culture and wanted and became enamored by it, and wanted to renew and restore what has been his family's past, that would be different. That'd be something to consider. But if the family's broken and there's no sense they know they're broken, there's no sense they know there's anything to repair, I'd have a lot of questions about that. When they're older, like, you know, talking about 18, 19, 20, you've got to give them a little more freedom to decide. You know, my daughter's still living in my house because she's going to university, and I want to help her do that financially. So there's rules here that she has to follow, and she wants to. But you have to be a little, you have to hope. I think by the time a kid gets to be 18, 19, 20, you just got to hope that you've instilled in them the values that they're going to carry forward.
Would you have different advice for the parents of boys, sending them out into the scene, as it were, than you would for the parents of girls?
I mean, I think it's interesting. I'm not sure exactly where this question is going, but I see if I'm not answering it the
I'm
right
not
way.
either, so don't worry.
I mean, honestly, so a lot of the boys that I've met have a problem with passivity, and I think it's important for the man to be the pursuer in a relationship, and I don't mean like a sexual pursuer. I mean just the I don't think a man should be trying to always have sex with a woman. That's not what I mean. But I do mean, you know, take the initiative, be the one who says, "Hey, we're gonna go. Let's go here. Let's do this. I'll pay for this. I'll open your door. I'll all the things that were kind of commonplace in the years past." But I think a lot of guys, even guys raised in real good Christian families, just don't know that that culture's so gone. It's lost. And I found this out. Like, I don't want to embarrass one of my sons, but I'll just say, you know, he took a girl out, and like the whole time he was asking, "How much is that? Is that expensive?" Or, you know, worried about how much money he's spending. And so I had to say, "Man, just don't ever ask. Don't do that, man. Just buy the thing. And if you're in a deficit, call me up. I'll send you the money. Just don't die.
That's funny.
I'll be your wingman. Don't worry." So I think guys just need to be taught how to be a gentleman, how to be chivalrous, how to be bold also. That, you know, you gotta make the first moves. You gotta ask for, you gotta tell someone what you think. If you're a man, you have to say, "Hey, I think you're beautiful. I'd love to date you. I think you're a good person. I would like to get to know you more." A lot of guys are terrified to do that. And so coaching boys to do that is important. And then coaching boys what to do if the unfortunate girl says yes. I mean, how do you then land the fish? And
Oh man, you're getting canceled for that one for sure.
I know. But then on the other side, so I think men need to learn how to be men and be non-passive, assertive, but polite, but chivalrous, right? And then women also need to look for men who do that. Like, I think who are I think most women want that. Most young women want that. There's little of that, and in fact, when they do find it, it tends to be with men who are not good, men who are looking or who are bold and aggressive because they want sex and are not bold and aggressive in a Christian way. So they're susceptible. So teaching my girls to tell the difference between a guy who is interested in you as a person, and who is not just think women, so both sides, women with men and women growing up, the other sex, even if you have lots of brothers and sisters, is a mystery in some ways. It still is. I mean, I'm married to Anne. I still don't understand half the things she does. But she doesn't understand half the things I do. But especially when it comes to sexuality and desire, the way those work for women and the way that works for men is in some ways similar, but in many ways very, very different. I think helping a girl know how a male sex drive works is super important in helping her interpret and understand how men are acting toward her. And to tell the difference between someone who is trying to have sex with her and someone who is attracted to her but is treating her honorably. I think a lot of girls don't know the difference between those two things. They want admiration because women are, you know, that's God made them beautiful, to be admired and to be chased after because of their beauty, right? That's a bad thing. But they need to know the difference between someone who sees them as beautiful and is attracted to them but wants to help them become more, you know, more beautiful in Christ, and someone who wants to bed them.
Can I interject here real quick and ask if you would you agree that we might be able to offer a word of comfort to fathers of young women who are hearing you saying, like, gosh, that sounds like a really hard conversation for me to have with my teenage daughter, but part of the reason that our culture struggles with this and that young women struggle with it so much is because so many of them don't have a father who loves them
That's
in
right.
the home, that they don't have that example of someone who is out to protect them, who does love them, who even in some sense finds them attractive, but in no way wants to have sex with them. That's not imaged for them at all. So out in the world, when they see any kind of desire or attraction, even if it's out of order, they see it as something they've been sorely lacking. So even if you're worried about having that conversation, being a Christian father to your daughter is doing a lot of that work.
The hunger that a girl has for male affection is huge. I mean, it's just they need their fathers to be affectionate toward them. And I don't mean like be weirdly in a weird way, but do they need that affection. And they also need, if that component is there, that goes a long way in helping them distinguish between a godly attraction on the part of a male to them, a man to them, and an ungodly sexual desire. If they can see a real kind, good, strong father who protects them and cares for them, that's what they're going to be looking for in a man. And some guy who just comes around and tries to subvert them is not going to be as attractive as it would be to a girl who's starved. A girl who's starved for that kind of affection is going to be looking for it anywhere she can find it.
Yeah, I think that's a good reminder too that, you know, the importance of these conversations open honestly and as early as you know age appropriate. There's a website called The Birds and the Bees, I think. Is that what it's called? I forget, the show notes, Nick. But it begins, you know, talking about these frank discussions, you know, with toddlers almost, you know, like you begin having body appropriate conversations. And the taking shame out of the conversation, particularly from Christians, like we of all people shouldn't be ashamed of talking about the goodness of sex, you know, it's just, but and the beauty of it in its proper context. And, you know, that's a hard conversation for people who were brought up, you know, perhaps in a shame-based culture about it. Then of course there's a lot of shameful things that people do that of course, you know, sort of muddying the waters. But, you know, Liza and I have been endeavoring to practice these conversations, you know, as early and as often as possible in the preparation of, you know, of being able to be frank and open and honest with 15, 16, 17 year olds, and not just sort of hope that, you know, if things are going well and never have a discussion with them about what's actually going on. And I think that also points to the hopeful necessity of being on the same team with respect to the husband and wife, you know, with your sort of goals and the reasons behind the goals, you know, because the goal is not just to have some, you know, virginal bride that's sort of white knuckled through life, you know, made it to the day. I mean, that could also be a recipe for disaster. You know, the goal is to teach the beauty and the goodness and the redemptive power of marital union. And all that, like you said, Matt, the model of that. And that was something that just was not really a part of the conversation that I was having as a Christian high schooler very much. It was very much a, you know, here's what you shouldn't do and here's why. So we hope you, you know, you've gotten the PSA and we'll talk about this, you know, next summer at summer camp when we have to talk again, you know. And it was, you know, and again, I mean, we all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You know, we all have areas of redemption and fallenness. But at the same time, you do hope that the conversation is taking place in an open and honest Christian way, at least in a way that, you know, I'm preparing myself and actually already had with 9 and 8 year old boy and 9 year old girl. Conversations and sort of, you know, explanations of things that, you know, I don't think I had until I was 14 or 15, you know. And again, it's I don't think it would have harmed me at 9 or 10 to have them, but it just wasn't part of the you know, the way things were being done back then. And so I think, you know, you even look down into like the way, you know, the modesty question for young women or women in general for that matter, and men to a certain degree, And you see how, when fathers are either absent or unconcerned or sort of just delegate all of these conversations to their wives, and they're not on the same team. Well, you see these, both the wives trying to dress down to a certain age and the girls trying to dress up to a certain age at the same time, and you have this confused household there, and it's all back to the Christian reality that it's ultimately our responsibility. It's our responsibility to teach and to defend and to provide and protect. And I think that you're exactly right, Matt, that a lot of what we see, the rise of these OnlyFans and the sort of wanton promiscuity and the kind of the hard-edged protesting that body counts don't matter and all this stuff that you see around these conversations around young adult sexuality are all just a function of hurt, wounded, broken people without their explicit knowledge of their heavenly father, much less their earthly fathers, who have been just thrown to the wolves. And people, men and women together, lost men and women in this particular area are not only vulnerable but susceptible to immense amount of trauma and pain. I mean those not in the modern way, but actual trauma and pain. And I think I think we have a lot of repenting to do as a society, but also there is encouragement for the Christian father, I hope, but looking ahead, there's a lot more to be worried about than I ever imagined. And I'm grateful for people that have gone ahead, but I'm also it's also brought me to my knees longer and more consistently than probably any other question. This how to navigate, 10 to 22, or 12 to 22, in a faithful, non-anxious, godly, peaceful way is well, it's something we're gonna walk through together.
I mean, I will say one other thing that surprised me actually, as a parent. You guys may, Nick, maybe you're gonna find this as you go on, but and JD is probably some years away for you, but I remember like being a teenager and just it's so terrifying to have to put yourself out there and be rejected, and it's so hurt. The most emotional pain I can remember feeling was when I got dumped by a girl I really loved when I was, late teens. And I don't think I've had the intensity of emotion that I had at that moment ever since then. So watching a child go through that, I mean, none of my children have had that kind of a loss yet. I'm sure that one will, more than one will, but the fear of that for me is pretty big. I'm definitely worried about my kids being rejected.
Yeah, really hurt.
Yeah, and I think it will hurt me more than it hurts them, I think. So it's interesting. Like they're trying to be objective and help them and counsel them in a way that will be godly and good rather than a way that will help them not be hurt is, and sometimes those things can be opposed, right? Right. You can the dating strategy for me as a non-Christian young man was a lot different than to protect myself and get what I want. Was a lot different a dating strategy from me as a pagan and advise my children as a Christian, and which sometimes will mean saying, okay, well, you got to be hurt in this situation. You got to suffer loss in this situation. You've got to be willing to take the hit in this situation. And that's tough to even contemplate.
And can we just say that level of feeling and wanting to protect your children from that kind of hurt is a mirror image of this ridiculous father that we see on Instagram or wherever, who's hurt by the idea that his children won't be free to harm themselves. This is a much greater vision of what parenting and fatherhood means to want to share good news with your children such that they know their savior and that they love other people because they were first loved by him.
I was just going to agree with you. That's super key. If your kids have Jesus, then they can be dumped by Chad, it's okay.
That's our closing statement. If your kids have Jesus, they can be dumped by Chad and it'll be okay. Well, that is going to be all the time that we have today. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm. We're going to be following the election results with you. We thank you for listening. If you'd like to keep the conversation going, you can be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirmandfaith.com. Follow us on social media, join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks as always to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.